acknowledge several co-authors, which unfortunately I neglected to get into the program early enough so that they were in the printed program, and I apologize for that. Especially Anne Genevieve Bannier contributed a lot to this, and I'm not just saying that because she happens to be in the audience, but all of these co-authors did contribute significantly, and they should have been listed in the program. Okay, I guess I'm the sole representative of social insects in this group, so I'll say a few words about social insects as invasive species. They play a significant role in terms of being very significant invasive insects. If you look at the sort of 100 worst offenders recognized by the Invasive Species Study Group, they recognize 14 insects in this group of top 100, and half of these are social insects, seven of them. Most of these are ants, five species represented here by the fire ant, the red-ported fire ant, and the Argentine ant. There's a wasp, the European hornet, and there's one termite, the Formosan subterranean termite, Coptotermes formosanus, and that'll be one of the main subjects that I'll be talking about today. So social insects are a significant component in terms of the really bad invasive insect species out there. A few words about termites. Despite the fact that they've been recently demoted, they've lost their rank of order and are now social cockroaches, but there are about 2,600 described species in seven families. These are mostly tropical and subtropical in distribution. But only a handful, really, fewer than six, can we really consider to be truly invasive. There are a lot of exotics. They've been introduced to different places and even become established, but not really have spread and become ecologically dominant in the way that we think of invasive species. But nearly all of these invasive species that do exist are lower termites, either in the belonging to the group the subterranean termites in the family Rhinotermitidae or the drywood termites in Calotermitidae. And the two termites I'll be talking about today are both subterranean termites. Well, one question we can ask is, why are there so few invasive termite species? If you think about it, we might expect there to be a lot more. First of all, termites are widespread and abundant. You find them all over the place. And they're frequently transported by humans. They often nest inside wood, and including lumber and all kinds of wooden products. They're frequently found on ships and in wooden goods and containers, and have been for centuries. So there's ample opportunity for them to be spread all around the world, and there's lots of evidence that they have been spread and introduced all around the world. And in addition, they have some life history characteristics that would seem to be very favorable for successful establishment and spread into these areas where they become introduced. And primarily, the primary attribute among these is their life cycle, represented here by the life cycle of subterranean termites, which is characteristic of the life cycle of lower termites. So colonies are founded by alates, the male and female alates, which become the king and queen, get together, lay eggs, produce the castes in the colony, the workers and the soldiers. Colony grows, becomes big and mean, and eats lots of wood, destroys houses and trees and all that kind of stuff. Pretty soon the colony reaches maturity where they produce nymphs, which will then go on to develop into alates, which will then swarm and start new colonies. In addition, the original king and queen, the primary king and queen, die, they can be replaced by secondary or neotenic reproductives from within the colony, either through young larvae or, in some cases, workers developing into these secondary reproductives. So that means that if you have just a small fragment of a colony, a piece of wood that's infested by workers, then you have a propagule that's capable, has all the necessary ingredients to regenerate the entire colony and then spread and infest and invade an area where it's been introduced. So the two main areas that I'll be addressing, two main questions, are ones that most of us are interested in when we're looking at invasive species. And those are, first, where did they come from? We're interested in identifying source populations, and this can help us direct regulatory efforts to prevent additional introductions from those areas to other areas. In addition, it can help guide efforts to find effective biocontrol agents that are genetically adapted to specific introduced populations. And there have been some examples with termites of people using molecular markers to identify source populations of some introduced introduced populations. The other question is, why are these invasive species, the successful ones, why are they so successful? And this usually involves comparing an native and introduced populations, both in terms of genetic diversity and levels of inbreeding, and in the case of social insects, looking at their social behavior and colony breeding structure. And there have been actually very few studies along these lines, besides the ones that I'm going to describe today. So the issue of social behavior and colony breeding structure is really important in terms of social insects because, as I mentioned, ants are some of the worst invasive species. Many species of ants have become very, very successful as invasives and cause lots of problems, and they have some characteristics in common. And generally, they tend to show reduced genetic variability, as most introduced populations do, in their introduced ranges, but that leads to big differences, big changes in their social behavior and social organization. So you can find reduced conspecific aggression, so you get a breakdown of colony barriers, a large change in colony breeding structure, usually involving high numbers of queens that can lead to these super colonies like we find in the Argentine ant, which rings the Mediterranean coast here and the Iberian Peninsula, as well as there's a similar one that goes all the way up the coast of California from San Diego to San Francisco. So in addition to forming these super colonies, they also exhibit really good choices in their places of residence. So we have the Argentine ant, and there are some differences with the fire ant. It's a little more nuanced situation, but it's very similar in terms of some of their characteristics. So we're interested in knowing, are there any similarities between what goes on in these invasive ants and what goes on in our invasive termites? So the two species I'll be talking about are both subterranean species, eastern subterranean termite Reticulotermes flavifes, and the Formosan subterranean termite Coptotermes formosanus. The U.S. plays a significant role in both of these, one in the form of a donor and the other in the form of a recipient. And these are the two species where we have the most information, although you'll see that we still have big gaps in our understanding about what's going on in these two species. But what I'm going to do is try to compare and contrast what we know about these species and see if we can come up with any general conclusions about why these two species are so successful as invaders. So first, eastern subterranean termite Reticulotermes flavipes has a very broad range here in the U.S., covering the eastern and central part of the U.S. It's been introduced to France and some other places. It was originally thought to be a different species, Reticulotermes santinensis, but it's quite clear now from molecular markers that it actually is eastern subterranean termite Reticulotermes flavipes. And I'll be mostly concentrating on the introduced populations in France, shown here, where it's in Paris, as well as 20 other departments in France. And these areas up here in northern France represent pretty cold, harsh climates that are well beyond the northern limits of the native subterranean termites that occur down here. So these are kind of novel environments that the species has become established in and invaded. And in these areas, it's usually associated with human structures. It damages trees. You can see mud tubes going up trees here in Paris. It also damages buildings. So historically, the first records of this species occurring in France are from 1750. And this is an important date because during this time, actually, New Orleans was a French colony. So there was a lot of trade going on between the US and France at that time. Also, it showed up in Hamburg, Germany in 1952, and Santiago, Chile, much more recently. We're not really sure where these two populations came from. And it's also showed up in Austria. And it's interesting to note that the specimen that the eastern subterranean termite species was actually described from came from a greenhouse in Schönbrunn, Austria. So what we're interested in doing is trying to get a little bit better idea of where in the U.S. this population that came to France originated from. So we've looked at this using mitochondrial CO2 sequence data, 680 base pairs, and this is a maximum parsimony tree. And I've only shown the bootstrap values that are greater than 550%. But what we see is that we have two fairly well-supported clades, these groups here, one representing samples east of the Mississippi and one representing samples west of the Mississippi, as well as our introduced invasive populations. The blue being from France, we have one sample from Germany, one from Toronto, which is a disjunct population that was most likely introduced from somewhere in the US, and then in the Bahamas where it's also been introduced. And it's significant to note that we had four haplotypes from New Orleans, and they all fit within this group here, west of the Mississippi. So I think it's pretty clear from this that most likely the introduced populations of reticulotermes in France came from somewhere west of the Mississippi. And we wanted to get a little bit better idea of where they may have come from. So we've used microsatellite analysis to look at nine populations, one from New Orleans and eight populations here scattered across the sort of mid-Atlantic region, and compared those to three different populations in France using 15 microsatellite loci. And this is a UPGMA tree based on those data. The important thing to point out here is that there's one well-supported branch right here which contains the three Paris populations with the New Orleans population right in the middle. So again, this is good evidence that these original populations into France came from either New Orleans or somewhere around New Orleans. But Anne-Jen Bannière and her group is going to be looking at this in more detail, going and sampling more intensively around New Orleans area to see if they can pinpoint more precisely where these came from. So now, the Formosan subterranean termite, Coptotermes formosanus, which is native to a big part of China, showed up in Japan probably around 400 years ago, in Hawaii in the early 1900s. Then it started showing up in the continental US in the late 50s, early 60s, around military bases, most likely with equipment brought back from the Pacific Theater after World War II. And significantly, it showed up right here near San Diego in 1992. And it's shown up in other places around the world as well. So to get a preliminary analysis of our idea of where these might have come from, we've used microsatellites to compare six native populations here in China, three of which were provided by USDA, and three of which Claudia Husenader and I collected earlier this year. And we compared those to eight introduced populations, two in Japan, three in the continental US, including New Orleans and Charleston, two of the sites where they were first introduced into the US, and three sites in Hawaii. And this is, again, a UPGMA tree showing the relationships between the different populations. There isn't a lot of branch support for many of these branches, but I do want to point out here that there is very strong support for this branch connecting New Orleans and Oahu, suggesting that the source of the New Orleans population likely came from Hawaii. I also want to point out that Charleston is on a separate branch, although there's not a lot of support for this branch, but we have other evidence to suggest that the population in Charleston was a product of a separate, independent introduction from that either into Hawaii or into New Orleans. And also Japan here comes out up here, and we're pretty confident that it also is the product of a completely separate and independent introduction. So our sort of working hypothesis is that from somewhere in or near China, mainland China, we had populations that were introduced in Japan. Separately, there was populations, there were introductions into Hawaii probably multiple times. Some of which were then introduced into New Orleans, possibly multiple times, we don't know. And then there was a most likely a separate independent introduction into Charleston. But this needs to be confirmed. But this varies somewhat with a recent report by Austin et al. Using CO2 sequence data, where they had only two haplotypes that varied at only two positions out of 667 base pairs. They concluded that Hawaii was kind of a melting pot of samples introduced from Japan as well as mainland China, and that Hawaii served as the sole source of populations introduced to the continental U.S. But they had only 10 samples from mainland China, so they had very limited sampling. So I think our data are a little bit stronger, but it would be good to combine both microsatellite data and CO2 sequence data, preferably in a region that's more variable than the CO2 region here, to get a better idea of where these came from. And in fact, we plan to on going back to China next year and probably the year after to collect additional samples, and maybe we'll get a better idea after we've analyzed those. So the second issue I want to deal with is why these species are so successful. And so first I want to just look at comparing genetic diversity in the native and introduced populations. And this is important because not surprisingly, introduced populations of many species show reduced genetic variation compared to native populations. And this is kind of one of the paradoxes of successful invasions. How do these genetically depauperate populations compete with the much more genetically diverse endemic populations that they're confronted with? So how do our introduced populations of our two termite species compare with the native populations in terms of genetic diversity? That's shown here, where we look at mean allelic richness, which is basically a standardized measure of the number of alleles per microsatellite loci. And for each species, the native populations are shown in blue, the introduced populations in orange. And you can see in both cases, there is a significant reduction in genetic variation between introduced and native populations. On average, 42% in the reticulotermes formis flavipes, which is greater than what we see in Coptotermes formicanus. But in both cases, we have significant reduction in genetic variation, which is not surprising, but it's good to get a quantitative measure of exactly how much that reduction actually is. So the next question is does this reduced genetic variation in introduced populations have anything to do with possible changes in the colony breeding structure? So, as I said before, reduced genetic variation in some ant populations has led to breakdown of colony barriers, high numbers of queens, the super colony formation, and so we want to see if anything like that is happening with our invasive termites. Are invasive termites acting like invasive ants? I mean, all termites really just want to be ants. At least that's what all the ant people tell me. Is that what we find? So to look at that, we look at the breeding structure of colonies within each of the populations by genotyping 20 workers at least 8 microsatellite loci, and then we infer family structure from these worker genotypes. Basically, we can classify colonies into one of three different family types. They can be simple families comprised of a monogamous pair of reproductives, one king and one queen and their worker offspring. We can have what we call extended families, where we have the multiple inbreeding neotenics. So if these primary reproductives die and you get the neotenics generated from within the colony, then these inbreed within the colony. And you usually have multiple neotenics. And actually, using F statistics and measures of inbreeding, we can actually get some ballpark figure of the number of neotenics in these colonies, whether they're relatively low or relatively high. So if you're a termite colony, the way you're going to add queens is you're going to produce neotenics, and to get high queen number, similar to ants, you're going to add lots of neotenics. Or you can have what we call a mixed family, so a genetically complex group that consists of multiple unrelated reproductives, and that can occur through colony fusion. But I'll say that we have some evidence that colony fusion occurs in native populations of Reticulotermes flavipes, but only very rarely. We have no evidence that it occurs in any introduced populations of Reticulotermes flavipes, and no evidence that it occurs in any populations of Coptotermes formicanus. So there doesn't seem to be a large breakdown in colony barriers in any of these populations. All of the colonies that we've looked at are genetically distinct. So they're either simple families or they're extended families. So if we compare then the native and introduced populations in the proportions of these two types of families, this is what we see. So we've got proportion of extended families. So those are the ones with the neotenics, the inbreeding neotenics within the colonies. So these are native populations in blue, introduced populations in pink. We can see that in Reticulotermes flavipes, the colonies with that are extended families with neotenics are actually a minority in most of our populations. Whereas in France, actually all of the colonies we've looked at all have neotenics. It's a very different situation. Unfortunately, we don't have any data yet from New Orleans, which would be good to get given the apparent strong genetic affinity between this area and the French populations. The situation in Coptotermes formicanus is a little bit more complicated. We've only analyzed three populations. We have three that we've collected but have not characterized yet. But in the three native populations, we find mostly colonies with neotenics or that are extended families. Whereas in the introduced populations, we see a whole mixed bag of things, from only 10% of colonies having being extended families to mostly extended families. So basically, we don't see any consistent shift towards having more extended families, with the idea of having more higher queen number in these introduced populations in this species. So as I said, we can infer the numbers of neotenics within these colonies, and I won't go into exactly how we do that, but we can basically get a ballpark figure based on F statistics for the colonies that can tell us if we have low numbers of neotenics, say 3 to 10, medium, between 10 and 100, or if we have very high numbers, 100 or more. So we compare native and introduced populations of our two species. Remember, in the introduced populations of Reticulotermes flavipes, all of the colonies that we've looked at in France, they're all headed by neotenics, and they all have very high numbers of neotenics. Compared to our native populations, when we do have extended families, they have much lower numbers. So there's a big difference here, not only in the proportions of extended families, but in the number of neotenics that those extended families contain. Whereas in the Coptotermes formicanus, it's really a mixed bag. It's variable both in the native and in the introduced populations. So another question is, does this affect the size of the foraging area? If you have lots and lots of neotenics, you've got lots of queens producing lots of eggs, can support a large population, you might expect to have very expansive colonies. So we compare foraging areas in the two ranges, introduced and native ranges, and we do see big differences in Reticulotermes flavipes. And this is just a couple of illustrations of that. One area that we studied in Raleigh, where each of these colored shapes is the foraging area of a single colony. And you can see at 10 meters, you know, we got foraging areas of maybe 100 square meters at the most. This is very typical of what we've seen in many of our populations for this species in native populations. However, in France, it's quite different. In this island off the coast of France, which was studied by a student of Angen Bagnères, Stephanie Dronet, we see that we have very, very expansive colonies. This one colony we estimated to cover an area of 90,000 square meters, which I think is one of the largest subterranean termite colonies ever described. And this is also in Paris, we can find very large colonies. So we do find much larger foraging areas in these introduced populations than in the native populations, presumably because they have large numbers of neotenics. And this seems to adapt the species to be able to survive in these colder, harsher climates that they've invaded in northern France. The situation in the Formosan subterranean termite is not as clear, it's not as well studied, for one thing. We know from many studies, introduced populations, you can have very expansive colonies covering 100 or more linear meters. But in native populations, it's not very well characterized. I think there's only one study that I could find that Nanyao had translated. And they described one colony or maybe a couple of colonies with foraging ranges of less than 50 meters. Here's some data of ours from an introduced population in Charleston. You can see very long foraging areas. This is 100 meters here, so a couple hundred meters in these colonies, which is typical to what's been described in other introduced areas. And this is from one population that we collected from this year in China. It's just two colonies, but these are both drawn to the same scale. You can see somewhat smaller foraging areas, but you know, it's a very little. It's not a very good comparison, and so I'd be hard pressed to draw any conclusions about it at this point. So in terms of conclusions. In the case of Reticulotermes flavipes, the French populations likely originated near New Orleans, if not New Orleans itself. Possibly there were multiple introductions, and there were probably secondary introductions for reasons I won't get into right now, from France to Chile and Germany. In the case of Coptotermes formicanus, it looks like it originated from or near China, perhaps some islands off the coast of China. We're hypothesizing that there were at least two separate introductions into the U.S. mainland, one through Hawaii, and then a separate introduction into Charleston. And then it looks like there was a separate introduction into Japan. So in terms of the colony breeding structure and foraging area, comparing the introduced and native populations, we have these two species, and we have kind of different stories about what's going on. Both show reduced genetic variation, which we're not surprised at. In the case of Reticulotermes flavipes, all of the colonies within the introduced range all have extended families. They all have high numbers of neotenics, and they seem to have very large foraging ranges compared to the native population. So in this species sort of acts like some of our invasive ants. Whereas the situation of Coptotermes formicanus is not so clear, there's no consistent difference in the breeding structure between native and introduced populations. So if we're looking for reasons why this species has been so successful, it doesn't seem to be related to changes in the breeding structure. So maybe other aspects of its biology, its foraging behavior, defensive behavior, colony growth, among other things, might be areas to look at. So these are just two species telling us kind of different things. We obviously have a lot more work to do on these two species to sort of fill in some gaps. And we need to add more species to see if there are any general patterns that emerge. And I think in this respect, Coptotermes, the genus, will play a significant role because there are several other species within this genus that are invasive. And so it'd be interesting to see how similar or different they are from the Formosan subterranean termite. And with that, I would like to thank again my co-authors, and again apologize for not including them in the written program, and thank this wonderful group of people for the lab and field support and these sources of funding. And thank you for your attention, and I guess if we have time, I'd be happy to answer questions. Nan Yao had his hand up first.
We just add a comment about the Chinese sea formicanus. Mm-hmm. There's a paper product published by Zong. He sampled more than 10 colonies of sea formicanus monkey capture study in Guangzhou, and all the foraging distance are less than 10 meters.
Okay.
Very small.
Did you translate that one?
Oh, it's in English.
Oh, it's in English. Actually, I emailed Jochen Mo, who we've been working with at Zhejiang University, and he said he has some colonies where he's documented that a forage over 150 meters, but so I don't know what the true story is. We wouldn't really expect a big difference if the difference is related to whether they have neotenics and the number of neotenics. So far, it looks like we wouldn't expect a big difference between the introduced and the, at least we wouldn't expect the introduced populations to be much more expansive than the native populations. Susan?
Currently working in Ohio. I'm a we South Carolina. When you physically examine these colonies in the field to support your efforts, how many Neotenics do you find?
We usually don't find Neotenics, and when we do, we don't find very many. But one thing I would say is that, so what you're looking at with the F statistics is you're looking at the what would properly be called the number of functional neotenics. So let's say you have 400 neotenics, but how many of those are actually functional? How many of those actually contribute to the worker pool? It's hard to say just by counting the numbers. Functional laying eggs, but are they all actually contributing to workers?
So you're saying that eggs don't survive?
It's possible. You could find this sort of thing in ants, where you have a certain number of queens, but if you actually look at the functional number of queens, it's lower because you have unequal reproduction, you have different fates of the eggs laid, some are not all that viable, and so on. So. I think that's what the statistics will tell you is basically what is the average number that are actually contributing. But it could vary a lot from one population to the next, too. So it'd be interesting to do the statistics on yours. If you could get enough colonies where you could actually count the number of neotenics. Yeah, Alan.
Yeah, if you look at the genetic structure of copper termites in North Carolina, which is kind of outside the native environmental range, but you also detect them, right?
Yep. Yeah, we have a paper we published last year, Environmental Entomology, describing that. Yeah, it seems to be kind of closely linked to the New Orleans area in terms of its genetic relationship, but in terms of colony structure and all that, it doesn't seem to be any different from what we've described in other populations.